Milan Kundera once wrote, "Between the approximation of the idea and the precision of reality, there was a small gap of the unimaginable, and it was this hiatus that gave him no rest." Well, for my guest today on the program, his hiatus certainly gave him no rest because he was busy working and raising a family, but it was a small gap of the unimaginable because it wasn't planned. And all of a sudden, a band was no longer a band, and what else could one do but move forward? Well, move forward, sure, but you know what else one could also do? Wait a few decades and reform the band. And that's exactly what my guest today on the program did. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
Does anyone know the way?
Music of the Jack Rubies, a band which features my guest today on the program, Ian Wright. Let me tell you a little bit about the Jack Rubies and Ian Wright. All right, so when I say reform the band after a few decades, I'm talking about three of them. The East London outfit, the Jack Rubies, may have gotten their start in 1987 and fired off two brilliant albums. 1988's Fascinating Vacation and 1990's See the Money in My Smile, but that was it. They literally dropped off the musical map after that. And it was a weird disappearance because they were poised for big things. They had critical acclaim, they toured with the Triffids, They Might Be Giants, Modern English, and the Blow Monkeys, and they were fan favorites on MTV's 120 Minutes. So what happened? Where did they go? Well, the short answer to the first question is, they went on hiatus. And the short answer to the second question is, New York, North Carolina, and England. That clears nothing up, right? Let me help just a little bit. By 1990, the musical landscape was changing. Things got weird with their record company. They were young men, acutely aware of getting older, and it just didn't seem to make sense to go on. I'll admit I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but that's kind of the gist of it. I'll let Ian fill in the gaps. Bummed as fans like me were that the Jack Rubies were gone, the good news is now they're back, firing with the same melodic accuracy and pop smarts that endeared them to fans in the first place. The Jack Rubies' third album, Clocks Are Out of Time, is a startling and welcome return to form. Filled with unforgettable hooks and lyrical smarts, the Jack Rubies are not only back, they're back with their original lineup. And this isn't just some kind of like unfinished business thing. The Rubies are here to stay. There's more music on the way, and they've never sounded better. So let's get to it. Here's me and Ian Wright of the Jack Rubies, having a conversation, right here, on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
I don't know how much you know about our sort of geographical status, but three of the band are in the States and two of the band are in the UK. And the sort of recording hub as such is in the UK, where our drummer slash producer Max has a pretty nifty home studio, which is where we do a lot of the basic recording. So in fact, we're working on, you know, since the album came out, I mean, the album was basically finished, I'm thinking June, July of 23. And we've kept working since then, sporadically, and we have a bunch of new stuff that we're just trying to knock into shape for whatever comes next. So I'm going to do a little work with him while I'm over there.
So this arrangement wouldn't have been tenable back in 1990. It would have been everyone's scattered around. Two people are there, one person's there, forget it. Now that's not the case, which means the Jack Rubies get to live on.
And even if we think back to, not that we were thinking of doing anything, say, 7-8 years ago, but even as recently as that, the technology, it might have been developed to some degree, but it wasn't as user-friendly as it is now. So again, a lot of things aligned to make this happen, but that aspect was certainly one of them. Yeah, the technology.
One of the worries, I think, early on was that sort of like if people were exchanging ideas over email or, you know, recording via Zoom or whatever, that the synergy of a band, the dynamic electricity, would be somehow lost. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think that really, that worry was unfounded.
I mean, I'm sure it differs in all, you know, we, one of the fantastic and gratifying things about this adventure we're on is that it's reactivated the chemistry that we always had, but we'd sort of forgotten about it in the midst of time. And it was really super to connect again on that level. And so the barriers of not being in necessarily in the same place all at once didn't seem to affect that too much. But we did have to adjust our way of working. There's no doubt about it. But I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing. In some ways, it's turned out to be a good thing, I think, because it challenged us and perhaps helped inadvertently to put a different spin on a more modern spin on the band, say, for example.
When the Rubies were done, mm-hmm. And this sort of your life was kind of upended and you had to figure things out and you went to art restoration and the whole deal. But is it fair to say that it nagged at you in the back of your head, that it was like unfinished business? I think almost minimizes it, but like this thing that you were doing was gone. Were you sort of carrying that around with you as something you really wanted to get back to?
Well, yes, in a way. In the first few years after the band broke up, my way of dealing, because I was to some degree, you know, traumatized by it, I think we all were to some degree. We just felt like it's just ended without us having any real control of the situation, but that's a long story. But my way of dealing with it was to sort of say, okay, I'm not even going to think about that. I'm just going to push it all to one side, kind of lock it into a imaginary cupboard, and just get on with other things. And that's sort of what I did, and that worked for a certain amount of time. But eventually, and probably because I was, whatever wounds had healed by then, let's say 10 to 15 years down the line, I did start to become more curious about it and less, less wound up about the way it had all ended. And that, you know, in a good way, perhaps started to nag at me. And that was probably the beginning. A very slow gestation, but that was the beginning of us starting to think about what to do, first of all, with the legacy that was there, and perhaps eventually doing some more music. That wasn't the first thought. It was more a case of, like, we've sort of been wiped off the face of indie history. Let's try and restore that, because of our own apathy, we just didn't engage on social media or try and make any case for the Jack Rubies being part of something. We were just all like went in different directions. So in that regard, yes, there came a point where I think collectively it started to nag at all of us.
Also, I imagine being in a band, being a guy in a band, was part of your identity. And so, you know, the notion of having to sort of figure out a career and figure out a life and figure out who you are and where you are, you probably also had to adjust your identity and the way that you perceived yourself.
Yeah. I mean, certainly I was one of those kids who, from an early age, like, you know, 10, 11, was obsessed with pop music, and to the point where I was, you know, I couldn't play guitar then, but I would be getting a tennis racket and, you know, miming to the British show Top of the Pops, which was like the weekly TV show, which I'm sure you're aware of, even to the extent where I would attach a piece of string or a yarn of wool to the tennis racket, like a guitar lead, and attach that to a radiator on the wall so it looked like an amplifier. I would go to that extent, you know. and rope in my younger sister to do various drumming chores and that kind of thing on cushions. So yeah, I was obsessed with it, and a lot of kids were, I'm sure. But my identity, and then you know, becoming a teenager, going to lots of shows, starting to learn the rudiments of guitar. Not in a band at that point. I wasn't in a band until I actually got to art school when I was about 18. But my identity, and also my reasons for going to art school, I was very interested in art and painting, but I also thought that's a good place to form a band. So that was in the back of my head too, you know, and that all came to fruition. So yeah, my identity from, 11, 12 years old, right through into my late 20s was all about being a musician and some kind of performer. So yes, that was, it's difficult to turn all that off. But I did have that second string to my bow in that, you know, I had this arts training, and as luck would have it, I almost fell into a job doing art restoration. But that's, and I didn't think that's what I was going to be doing for the next couple of decades, but that is actually what happened. Yeah.
And also metaphorically, now it's the restoration of your own art, your own
that's
band.
Very true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is cool.
Interesting. Yeah.
When you were hometown for you specifically was where?
I grew up in Birmingham in the middle of the UK, and I went to the early band, three of the band met in the town of Reading, which is about 40 miles west of London, if you don't know that. And it's a college town, and that's where I went to art school. So I spent the next few years there and met two of the other future Jack Rubies. One was at the art school, one was a local kid who lived in the town. And from there, we moved to London. This is in the very early 80s. And the most of the 80s were spent in London. Yeah, and that's before I came to the States.
I imagine in Birmingham, there was a lot of great music, a lot of reggae, a lot of like really cool, interesting stuff happening.
Very
so
true.
I imagine your hometown was fertile ground for seeing bands and seeing cool, like UB40, aren't they from your Birmingham too?
But they are actually UB40. Funnily enough, my father was a GP, you know, a family doctor, and UB40 were his patients, and he was the members of the band. It was like a big thrill for him to be like, yeah, I've just given them their medicals so they can go on tour and da da da. So yeah, so UB40 actually come from the same little part of Birmingham that I grew up in. But yeah, there was all that scene, and then a little bit further down the road, Coventry, which is very near Birmingham, it's not Birmingham itself, that's where all the two-tone thing kind of began, Specials, etc. And then so you had a lot of multiracial bands happening, because that was part of the makeup of the population in that part of the country. So you would have other things like Dex's Midnight Runners, and also, let's see, gosh, I can't think of another one right now. There's a cool reggae band that came from there. What were they called? From Handsworth. I'm trying to think what the name of the band was now. Anyway, reggae was definitely part of the scene growing up as a kid. And then there was the other thing about that part of the country was it was a big early heavy metal kind of scene. Black Sabbath came from that part of the country. Members of Led Zeppelin, Plant and the drummer. And so there was all that. And then, of course, you had, as you mentioned a minute ago, Duran Duran at a slightly later stage, that whole kind of, slightly glitzy, not exactly new romantic, but kind of feeding off what was the last vestiges of UK glam rock. You know, there was all that going on. So it was quite a different or quite a vibrant stew going on in that part of the country.
Were you devouring all of it? Were you into the hard rock, the reggae, the pop? Were you more of a selective?
I was not so much into the hard rock of it, to be honest with you, certainly at that age. So I was definitely into the reggae side of things. And I mean, starting off, I would say that my earliest influences were UK glam rock. So, you know, we're talking about T-Rex and that kind of thing, Roxy Music, David Bowie, all that. But as I got a little bit older, yes, as the sort of first part of punk happened and into new wave, reggae was a big part of that because, you know, it was another form of rebellious music that it became the black music of choice for young punks. Let's put it that way.
Was Stephen Duffy a contemporary?
I think he may be a little bit older than me, but I've never met him. But he was, and don't forget, I left Birmingham when I was about 17. So that's when I went 17, 18. So most of my appreciation and seeing a lot of the decent bands that were around at the time happened after I'd left Birmingham and was either in Reading or in London.
My theory as a creative person can't be silenced. And so if you are not making music for 30 years, it's coming out in other places. And I know art restoration is an art in itself. Were you doing anything else? Were you painting? Were you writing? Were you doing the creative muscle for the last, 30 years or so? How is that being flexed?
It's an interesting question. I think I certainly regarded, because, I set up a business with a partner from scratch in the heart of Manhattan. I mean, that's kind of, I didn't take it as a huge challenge at the time, but looking back on it, it was really quite ballsy to do that. And we were sort of like the renegade competitors to a lot of other bigger studios who were doing similar work. And that became like almost business as art, if you know what I'm saying. It's like the actual creation of it and the success of it fulfilling it in that regard. In terms of actually pure artistic pursuits, the truth is there were one or two little musical side projects that I got involved with, nothing that really came to very much, and partly because I'm not sure if my heart was totally in it. And then the other thing I did, which, is a creative act, is I had a few children, and that takes up a lot of time as well, so there was all that was going on, and but I very much had put to bed the idea of doing anything serious in the musical vein again. And people would often say to me, a lot this happened, people say, oh, why don't you just do some music for yourself, just for fun, you don't have to be in a band on the road and making records. And I just always said and firmly believed the only way I can do it with any conviction is to be absolutely laser focused and doing that and nothing else at all, because that's the way I do it.
You couldn't just dabble.
I couldn't dabble, and other members of the band could. They're the kind of, they perhaps, maybe some of the non-writing members of the band would be quite comfortable being in a jam band who played on Saturday afternoons, or join a little band to go and play the odd gig in bars and pubs. But that was never my scene. And I've never been somebody who could, let's do some cover versions or something like that. It's been the songwriting itself that has been the driving thing for me.
Was there like this sort of thing where you had the instruments, but you were consciously not picking them up?
Yeah, we have, I encouraged my children to get involved with music. We have a piano that's there, which I very rarely play, but they play from time to time. When they were younger, they played it a lot. And, I had a few guitars kicking around, but I tried to push them into the dark corners. I was almost being stubborn about it. I was like, I'm just not going to do it. I've stopped. I've finished. I've drawn a line. And by the time that stubbornness kind of eased, I sort of just got in the habit of not doing it.
Yeah, because how invested were you in that line? Because it seems to me like it was a great way to protect yourself from the wound of, the band not being around anymore. And the stubbornness, I'm sure, helped,
Yeah. I don't know. I think when we actually did sort of reactivate the Jack Ruby's sort of muscle memory, whatever you want to say, the first thing I thought, I was in a, various people in the band were enthusiastic and various people in the band were skeptical, ranging all the way to, I'm definitely not doing this. I was in the sort of middling skeptic camp. mainly because I thought, I don't know if I can write any songs anymore. But once the muscles started to flex and we started to feel slightly encouraged about what we were doing, my main emotion was, why have I deprived myself, not just for a few months, but for years, let alone decades, from the enjoyment? Even if nobody hears this stuff, why did I deprive myself of something that gives me so much pleasure? And, you know, I suddenly felt like, you know, all these forgotten lights inside have been turned back on again. It was really quite remarkable. And then also part of me thinks, well, if this had happened at an earlier stage, maybe the effect wouldn't have been the same. Maybe it would have been, for whatever reason, maybe it wouldn't have been so appealing and it would have just made me go again, well, see, told you so, you shouldn't have done that. So I think the timing was perfect for whatever. The timing's mad. I mean, bands don't generally stop doing, you know, if they break up and they might reform a few years later, if they're going to reform, or perhaps even on a 10-year anniversary. But you don't just like sort of go to sleep in a cryogenic chamber and forget all about it for 30 years and then suddenly go, okay, let's carry on again. I mean, it's mad, but perhaps that's what's good about it.
Yeah. And the answer to that question is probably because it was just too painful for a long time.
To start with. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I've been like, drowning my sorrows for decades on end. No, I'm talking about there was a raw feeling right at the beginning for 2 or 3 years, because it was a messy end. It was a messy end with the record company, and it was suddenly it seemed like the carpet had been pulled out from underneath us, and we were all a little bit weary from being on the road for a long time and not having been partaking of normal life, as in, you know, day-to-day life. We were living out of suitcases for a long time. It just suddenly was a bit difficult to readapt to trying to do something else. But that didn't go on for years and years and years. It went on for a short while, but in that early time, I certainly kind of made a decision to push it all to one side.
I don't know if you're a competitive guy or not, but I imagine when the band ceased that you didn't stop listening to music. And if you were listening to music and then you heard stuff that you liked, was there a part of you that was like, I'm better than those guys? Or did you have that kind of like competitive streak?
Well, there's several answers to that. One is that when, at least first time round, I'm not sure if it's true now, but first time round, when I, being in a band made me super competitive of my peers, and to the extent where I discovered that a downside of that was I stopped liking other music quite so much because I wasn't listening to it as a fan. I was listening to it as a competitor. That was a kind of a sorry state of affairs, but I recognized that. So when the band actually stopped, a good byproduct of it was, not immediately, but as time went by, I suddenly became a fan of music again. Because I wasn't thinking, oh, I've got to come up with something to compete with that. So that was nice. I actually did start listening and very much enjoying music again. But the other side of that, or another side of that, was that as time went by, many bands who came along, let's say we're talking about, you know, 10 years later by now, people say, I love this. Have you heard? I'm not going to give examples because I can't think of a specific one off the top of my head, but people would say, you know, have you heard this? It's really great. You might like it. And I say, yeah, it's good, but, you know, sounds really, I kind of a lot like such and such band who did almost the same thing 10 years ago. And I know music is always reinterpreted and stolen and, you know, redone things. I've done it myself. But I began to, you know, having lived long enough to have been through several different phases of music, it was harder and harder to find something that really floated my boat. When music opened up through, you know, the way we listen to music now, I totally, apart from the fact that artists can't really make any money out of it, that's a whole other story. But the fact that you can listen to almost anything and discover things that you never would have found in the past because they were just too obscure, I really like that. I think that's really a great thing for somebody to broaden their musical horizons. And, you know, I applaud that part of it.
So you were able to shift into just being a guy who listened to music, being a fan.
To a large degree, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of that competitive part of you, though, doesn't really go away, right? I mean, there is...
Well, like I said before, I when I started my business a few years after the Jack Rubies first split, a lot of that competitive and creative energy went into that, and it was very full on because you're trying to get a business off the ground in a very competitive place, i.e. Manhattan. So yeah, those energies and that part of my character kind of went into that. But and also there's something to be said for the fact that I'm not one for growing old gracefully, but you do mellow out a little bit as you get older. So you're maybe not quite the angry young man, or as angry as the angry young man you once were, you know?
The angry-ish young man.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You've got to keep a bit of that in there. You've got to keep a little bit of that in there.
There are three things you need to do: guitar, singing, songwriting. Rediscover those muscles. How was it to rediscover your singing voice? Like, were you singing in the shower in 1997 and you were still, you know what I mean? Like, in other words, was it difficult for you to reclaim that voice? And has your voice changed?
Interestingly, when we first started getting back together again at a talking stage without actually having done anything, the other writer and sometimes singer in the band certainly does most of the backing vocals, SD Einson, he was the one member of the band who pretty continuously had carried on doing one musical project or another. He said to me, well, the thing is, Ian, you know, you've got to get your voice back into shape because it's going to have changed and you haven't sung for a very long time. And I was nervous about that. But surprisingly, it came back. Well, first of all, it hadn't changed that much. And that's probably because I hadn't used it. His had evolved and become, you know, steeped in living and singing all these years. And his voice has changed a little bit in a good way. But mine had not changed very much. You know, when you compare the sound of my voice on a recording made 30 years ago and something I recorded 2 years ago, it's the same guy. And so I think the layoff, funnily enough, protected my voice. It's almost like it was just left alone and I didn't strain it and I didn't exercise it in the way that I would have done. I've we haven't performed live yet, so I've yet to see how that actually would work out. And not so much the thing about playing live is you have to sing for a long time. It's not just you do one song in a studio and you can refine parts of the vocal or whatever, but live it's a one shot and you do it and then you do it again and again and again and again, you know, however many songs are in the set. So that may be an interesting challenge when we get to that point. But in terms of actually having the confidence to sing in the way that I've had in the past, it wasn't that difficult.
That must have been a pleasant surprise.
It was. It was key. It was key to the whole thing.
There's gonna be a feast. Hippie skippy downtown crowd. Hey Casanova, tell me when it's over. All the happy people making me frown. Got real. Miss Jehovah got a big bulldozer.
Native's attitude towards Jack Rubies? Were they dig up those records and go, what's this? How aware were they of what you had done, and how aware are they now of what you do?
Well, they were always aware of it, not because I rammed it down their throats, but because, you know, there's the odd post around the house, and my wife would certainly tell them that your dad used to be in a band and stuff like that. And I would encourage them to get into music themselves. But I'm not sure how actually aware of it they, you know, if something came up on YouTube, they would be a little bit like nonplussed by that. But once I started doing music again, properly, and with all the flurry of like re-releasing the old records, and the fact that I'm busy now, you know, like right now they're wondering what you're doing an interview on Saturday afternoon. Okay. You know, that, all that it's, right. Yeah, they're pretty damn well aware of it right now. And, I have two daughters. My younger daughter is, actually sings on the song Poltergeist, which is on the new record. So it was an experiment, and there was some bribery involved, but I managed to get her to do that chorus part, which came out great.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's on a track, and she's quietly approving of the whole thing, I hope. And my older daughter as well is certainly aware of it, and they don't make a huge fuss about it, because that's just not who they are. And they're also of an age where they are, you know, their concerns are much more to do with their peer group than what their old dad did or does now. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. What is the assembly line process for you in terms of, and I'm sure it's different from 30 years ago, you write a song, you're super excited about it. Do you show it to your wife? Do you play it for your kids? Like, who do you go to first when you have finished something or you're excited about something?
Well, usually the band, but if it's no doubt that if I've got something that I'm working on, I may very well run it by my wife actually and say, you know, if it's in a very early stage, like in a very much a demo stage, voice, guitar, or maybe a few, or a drum machine or something like that. Yeah, she will definitely be a good sounding board. Not so much my kids, but usually what happens is, and this used to happen back in the day too, that the way the band works is that either I would write a song, or SD Einstein would write a song, or he and I would write a song together, usually because we'd finish off on a bit of the other person's song. And then we would immediately bring it to the band, who would sometimes not want to continue with it, which was their prerogative, or they would be excited about it and interpret the song in their departments of operation, whatever they might be, bass, drums, etc. And in many cases, it would take on a new, with that arrangement, it would take on a new life of its own. But so the most exciting thing is having a new piece and seeing what the other members of the band, how they approach it and how they interpret it. And that's true if we're all in the same room in a rehearsal studio in 1990, or if we are swapping files over the internet, because we do it very quickly.
A guy in a band never has any trouble getting a girl. Did you meet your wife while you're in the Jack Rubies, or was that post Jack Rubies?
Post Jack Rubies.
Well done.
Yeah.
Because you had a real advantage early on.
I'm not sure how you want me to answer that question. But yes, you know, goodness me, everybody is different. But there is that cliche, isn't there, about that's one way to get a girlfriend is to start playing guitar. But who knows? Who knows if that's true or not?
A friend of mine in high school got into a band, and, you know, he was invisible. He picked up a guitar and is playing at a party, and all these girls start talking to him. And he said, why didn't I think about this years ago? I should have done this years ago.
It's a good one, isn't it? It wasn't, I honestly swear, it was not my prime motivation as a teenager. It was a considering factor. But actually, I just loved the idea of standing up with a guitar around my neck and doing some music.
Has your perspective in terms of, as a writer, Have you noticed differences there? I mean, these are songs, what I'm really asking is, these are songs you're writing now you probably couldn't have written when you were 20.
I agree. I can't go back in time to root around in the 20-year-old Ian's brain to tell you how he did that then so much. But I do know that what I didn't want to do was do a rerun of the old Jack Rubies lyrically. You know, I'm perfectly pleased with the lyrics that were written in the first incarnation of the band, but I didn't want to rewrite those songs again. That's for sure. I didn't want to do that. So I was looking around. You know, you don't go to yourself, or I don't anyway. What's the next song going to be about? But what I do, and what I did then as well in a slightly different way, is I've always got, since I started writing again, I've always got like a, if not a notebook, in my phone or on my computer, I've just got a constantly running, you know, sort of, every time I hear something that might be a kernel of an idea, even if it doesn't make any sense at all the next time I read it, I'm just, if I hear something, a chance, tiny bit of conversation on the street, or I see something in a newspaper, or something mad occurs that could work, I'm always writing that down, noting it. And then it may be months till I go back and look at it. And sometimes in a sort of cut-up way, two disparate things suddenly work and gel together, and that will set off the journey of writing a new song. So it's almost like I'm waiting for the collision to happen. It's not like I'm going, okay, this one's going to be about da 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 da. You know,
as an artist, that's not a decision that you have any power over.
True. And I think I did that to some extent when I was younger too, but I've always been interested in a lot of wordplay. And, you know, a little bit of twisted dark humor in there. It's the songs that might seem on first glance to be of the more miserablest style are always tempered by some kind of humor in there. That's always appealed to me, just to lighten things with that. And sometimes, you know, if I can find a line that actually makes me giggle, I'll put it in there, you know.
I had a Maxell XL2S tape, mm-hmm. Jack Rubies on side A, Lloyd Cole's self-titled album from 1990 on the other side, and I listened to it relentlessly.
Very nice.
I always felt Lloyd Cole was a you were in that sort of pocket in terms of sound, sonically, yeah, very much, but also from a perspective as a writer, because the songs were quite literate and quite playful in spots and clever.
Well, I'm chuckling a bit under my breath because that you're not the first person who's ever brought up the Lloyd Cole comparison. And, you know, I think sometimes the timbre of our voices is a little bit the same. And yes, perhaps the subject matter, you know, we are writing in occasionally the same sort of area. But the funny thing about all of that is that it's actually going back a little bit of time now, probably about 15 years ago, I ended up playing on a expats soccer team in New York, of which a member of the team was Lloyd Cole. And so he was not unaware of the fact that the Jack Rubies had been compared to him. That's more than once in past journalism. And I'm not sure he was completely enamored about that, but we did play soccer together for a year or two, actually. I haven't seen him for a long time, but so there's a connection there. We avoided the topic. Let's put it that way. We avoided the topic of comparing his great success with, you know, whatever the Jack Rubies might have done, and whatever comparisons there may or may not be. But it's kind of an in joke with the band, I have to say.
Nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was very good at managing. He wasn't the manager per se of the soccer team, but he was. He would have. He had a clipboard and would have some tactics, and he was very organized. And some of his band members were on the team too, and they were a great bunch of people. It was an interesting team, because what it was a friend of mine who was nothing to do with the music business. I don't know, he knew Lloyd Cole locally, and I think they had kids the same age. I think that's what it was. But Lloyd Cole, of course, knew many musicians who lived locally in Manhattan. I didn't know them. He did, and he brought a lot of people in. There were quite a few, interesting characters on there. But it was a good time.
My perception of the Jack Rubies is, and I'm sure this is wrong, but you guys seem to be operating like this sort of kind of monolith. You must have had contemporaries that were close friends. You must have had bands that you hung out with. And I don't know if you kept in touch, but I mean, the Jack Rubies weren't operating alone. I don't know where I'm getting that mythology from in my brain. But did you have close friends that were in other bands? And did you guys have that sort of relationship that was maintained?
Yeah, to some degree, yeah. I mean, we didn't strive to be outsiders within the so-called C86/post-punk whatever genre, which no one referred to that as a thing at the time anyway. But we didn't also want to be pigeonholed. And there were some bands that did. There were some bands who were like a gang of bands. We certainly weren't snobbish or standoffish with the other bands that were in the scene. A lot of times, you'd end up playing with, I mean, the bands I can think of who we would run into a lot on the road would be people like the Wonder Stuff and the House of Love, for example, the early My Bloody Valentine, before, they were actually more of a surf garage band to start with. But we would play the same venues a lot of the time with these bands. And so you would, sometimes you'd borrow an amp or you'd borrow a snare drum or something like that. There was a camaraderie there for sure. In terms of like being bosom buddies, there were a few bands that were, but none of them. We lived in a part of London, in North London, in Hackney, which was a bit off the beaten track. There was a band called the Raw Herbs. I don't know if you ever came across them. There was another band called the Palookas, which was, the singer was an ex-member of Swell Maps. So they had this kind of cool, ancestry. And there was another band called Francis Anthony and the Underworld. But the reason I'm mentioning all those bands is because they had some success, but they didn't ever get out of that sort of enclave so much as perhaps we did. Those are the bands that we really like to hang around with, and have, we all lived in the same neighborhood, go to the same parties, drink in the same pub, and often do gigs together. When I said before in this chat how I was competitive and aware of it as a young musician, I know for a fact that a lot of the bigger bands I mentioned, Wonder Stuff, House of Love, etc., as pally as they may be when you come across them to do a gig together, were also competitive as well. But it's a funny world, when you're on the road. I remember when we first came to the States, and we played in Chicago at the Metro. I remember that. And I was having a drink in the bar afterwards, and I ran into Sean Ryder, who I'd only met once before, when we did a gig with Happy Mondays years before. And he was like, the last time I saw you, you had a teddy boy haircut, because I had quite long hair at the time. And then he said, yeah, we're playing here tomorrow. And it was just, that sometimes musicians will just let it. It doesn't matter that you didn't see them the week before. You know what I'm saying? It's like we're all in this kind of adventure together, and it's nice when that happens. The band we bonded the best with, we did a lot of tours. We were very much a road band. We banded a lot with Modern English in the States, and I'm still friends with those guys. But earlier in England, the band that we were big fans of, because you don't always get to be touring with the band you're necessarily fans of. It depends what the record company or the agent fixes up. But the Australian band, the Triffids, were heroes of ours and incredibly nice people. And we really bonded with them on that tour.
That band is and remains one of the great gems of the last 100 years. I mean, I think they're such an important, beautiful band, and also so sad that the way it ended for David.
Yeah, it was really, you know, it was many years after we had been knocking around with them, but yeah, it was we were collectively shocked when we heard about that.
Sweet guy.
One of the least show busy guys, or kind of, you know, stardom obsessed people I've met. He was the kind of guy who would help the support band move their gear onto the stage, or you know, out of the van into the venue, that kind of thing. Yeah, for sure.
What's cool about him is that I got the reissue of Born Sandy Devotional, and I was looking at it, I thought, this guy plotted this album. I mean, he really, it wasn't like, I'll write 12 songs and see what happens. He had plotted it and thought about it thematically and sequentially. And so I'm glad to hear you say that, because he was devoted to the craft, obviously, but his ego seemed to not really be a problem. It sounded like he was just, you know, just driven by something in the self that had nothing to do with the outside world. So it's kind of cool that he was able to be such a generous fellow and also be so intense about his own craft.
Yeah, because, you know, he was a very intense, I don't know if you saw the Triffids, but he was a very intense, charismatic performer. And you'd almost suspect that he would be unapproachable, but he was off stage, but he was completely the opposite. He was extremely, quite shy. His brother, who was in the band too, was much more of a offstage comedian and personality in a way. Davey was sort of smoldering in the background, but he was great. He was a great guy.
Did you guys ever play with the Go-Betweens?
No, but the Go-Betweens were always... Oh, by the way, I just listened as well to the interview you did with Lindy Morrison the other day as well. That was very interesting. But I remember the Go-Betweens always used to be, when we was just starting out, and you know, we'd go and... not when we were necessarily playing, but we'd go and see a lot of bands like Pixies and stuff like that when they first came to London, and whoever else was current. And I remember that Go-Betweens were almost always in the audience or in the sort of backstage area. They were always around and about town all the time. The only time I've never met them, but I saw them live once, and this was kind of spectacular because they were opening up for the very early Smiths, and that was the first time I saw the Smiths in a small venue. That was... both bands were good, but it was a pretty spectacular evening.
Were you on board with the Stone Roses?
Yes and no. And here's a scoop for you. They supported the Jack Rubies once. They say they never supported anybody, but they actually opened up for the Jack Rubies once, very early on in Sheffield. There's posters to prove it on the internet, because there's the guy who did the poster. I don't know. He sells the poster now on the internet. Anyway. They were good that night, and I really like the first record. Yeah, it's a classic. We shared the same publicist, so we were getting their records, kind of, you know, the odd free copy of their singles and stuff before it was really overly known. I mean, the first album, yeah, it's pretty spectacular. But I'm not sure. I don't know what happened to them afterwards. I don't know why they went off into that kind of strange direction of, like, I don't know. I know we haven't done anything for years, but in that particular situation, it was bizarre that they kind of marked time like that. And I'm not sure if I particularly like the material they came up with after the first album.
There's a band who a break did nothing for. It just completely rocked their momentum and took it away. And
yeah,
you know, they came back, and it was like it. The world had changed, first of all. And that was, you know, so they'd kind of like the boat they were steering had gone complete in other direction. So for them, the world changed too quickly and they were gone for too long. So, you know, it almost like it had passed them by. So they sounded almost dated in some weird way, not relevant anymore. So that didn't benefit them at all. But some bands, you take a break. I guess you take a break long enough, and it doesn't make a difference anymore, right? I mean, it's like, but a 6 or 7 year break when you were at the top of your game, that's fatal.
I mean, it's like I say, it's funny talking about this considering our situation. But I suppose, yeah, if you go past that 6 or 7 year mark and keep waiting, maybe everything comes around again. But in their particular case, it was a bizarre, you know, they had everything really at their feet. And that for some reason, having said all that, they are regarded as a very important band in the history of the whole thing. And it's not like they made the one great album and then were forgotten about. They've been constantly remembered all the way through. So, you know.
That's right. Are there any live recordings of the Jack Rubies that would come out for you? Does anyone have any sort of have preserved any great shows that you guys did that could actually be even released as a live record digitally or physically?
That's a good question. There are definitely recordings of what standard I'm not, you know, the person who has most of the live shows on tape is Max, drummer, producer Max, who I was talking about at the beginning. So I need to pick his brains a bit about that. There was a compilation that probably you can find on whatever it's called, Discogs or something like that, that came out with bands. It was a week of live gigs at the ICA in London, and it included bands like The Wonder Stuff, and we have a track on it, and it's all live, and so that's out there, a solitary track from that compilation. It's pretty obscure though. But in terms of actually a full show, I don't know. Certainly a lot of shows were recorded, but that's something I need to follow up on.
How were you guys as a live band? I mean, because the records were really polished, not, and I mean that in a really good way. It was like just these perfect pop songs, but in a live setting, mm-hmm. would it go a little feral? Would you
yeah.
scruff it up a little bit?
Yeah, we were a good, I'm not, you know, not to toot my own horn, but we were a pretty damn good live band, and we loved it. We were very noisy. It was more noisy, and that was one of the things that separated us from some of our early contemporaries, not the noise factor, but the fact that we would ham it up a little bit. We would talk a lot to the audience. We would not be just standing looking at our shoes and playing our songs and not saying anything until the end of the set. We would actually muck around a little bit on stage and be quite, hopefully, entertaining as part from the music itself. And we had a reputation for that, like teetering on chaos sometimes, but in a good way. We loved playing live, and we would approach each performance as, you know, a performance, and not like just doing a rota by numbers kind of thing.
There was a little touch of the punk in the Jack Ruby's live approach.
Sure. I mean, yeah, we like to break down that wall. I mean, for sure. That's S.D. Einstein was very good at that. He would have many he would always have a quip at the ready when somebody was shouting something out from the audience. But I mean, at smaller gigs, I would be regularly running into the audience and rolling around on the floor. So that kind of thing, I'm not sure if I'm going to do that now. That kind of thing would often happen. Or even I dread to think how I didn't get punched sometimes. I mean, I would grab a drink out of somebody's hands, slurp it down, pour half of it all over my face, give it back to him, and get back on stage again. I mean, that kind of thing would happen in the heat of the moment, not planned at all. And I'm not saying that was a regular occurrence, but it certainly happened a few times. And some of those gigs were kind of a bit riotous. So when you compare that with, as you say, you know, we approached our studio work in a different way. We wanted to make great records, but we wanted to perform them with as much energy and live, make it an event without, you know, we still played really well, but we would definitely put a lot of showbiz into it as well.
I mean, to me, the happiest part of this whole story is that it's not the Jack Rubies, like two guys from the band. This is the original band, which
sure.
is awesome. I mean, for a music fan, a fan of the Rubies, that's great. But for me, just as a person, it's cool to hear that guys that you knew for so long and so well, that you guys are still friends, to me, is the bigger story. And I think I know that sounds awfully sentimental, Ian, but I think it's a cool thing.
I wasn't going to do it unless everyone was going to be involved. We'd never fallen out. We had remained at least in sporadic touch over all the years, but we never stopped being in touch. Steve Brockway, the bass player, who also lives quite near me in Brooklyn, for whatever reason, we've always been relatively close geographically, not all the time, but most of the time. So I don't think a month has gone past, or a month or 6 weeks has gone past in 30 years when I haven't seen him. So he's always been a presence, which is great. That's kept some kind of unity there to start with. Steve Einson, SD Einson, although he was the one who left the band when it was floundering. There was no hard feeling about that. We were all frustrated and we didn't blame him at all. But he officially left the band and in 91, I think it was. And but that didn't stop, and he eventually relocated to North Carolina. But that didn't stop us remaining in touch, and we would regularly meet up from time to time. I saw less of the two guys in England just because, you know, I was here and they were there. But we've always kept in touch. And it was critical for me that all five would be involved. I didn't know Steve Einson would want to do it, but he turned, because he was the one, that's the reason I said that, because he'd actually left and eventually started doing his own pursuits. But he was one of the cheerleaders. And that for me was like a kind of, wow, Steve's going to come back on board. This is going to happen.
On a gut level, it's kind of an amazing thing you guys are back, though, isn't it? It's pretty cool.
I mean, this has been going on for a couple of years since we really started this project or reanimating this whole thing. And I just every day I wake up going, oh, yeah, I'm doing this again now. Okay. It's brilliant. And of course, you know, it's gone from one stage to the next very nicely. You know, the first thing was just personal satisfaction for the five of us. Oh, yes, we can actually do this. This sounds good. I wonder if anyone else will like it. Putting out just self-releasing a track, and yeah, people did like it. It got a little bit of attention. Carrying on writing, you know, one step led to the next, and it eventually, of course, led to Big Stir getting involved, which has been marvelous, and they've been such a incredible label for us to deal with. So, two years ago, I think we all said to each other, "Well, in the best case scenario, we'll write something decent, and maybe we'll find a label who will fit the bill and just be the perfect home for us. And maybe even we can get the back catalogue reissued." That's the best case scenario. But in the meantime, let's just put some stuff out on Spotify. Well, here we are 2 years later, and kind of, dare I say it, dreams come true. That's what we hoped would happen. And so far is what has happened.
There you go. Ian Wright of the Jack Rubies. They've never sounded better. Welcome back, fellas. It's been way too long. Really happy you're here. You can find the Jack Rubies music, including their brand new album, The Clock Is Out of Time, at thejackrubies.bandcamp.com or bigstirrecords.com. Hang on a second. I'm being flagged down by my producer, which can only mean one thing. I've screwed up. What did I do? The Clock Is Out of Time? What is the name of the album? Clocks Are Out of Time. I blew that. I said the clock is out of time. It's plural. Clocks are out of time. I got confused. All I can tell you is the album is amazing. Clocks Are Out of Time is the title of it. Yes, I knew it had something to do with clocks and time and some of it running out. So I was in the right neighborhood. Okay. Clocks Are Out of Time by the Jack Rubies. Get it. You're going to be really happy you did. The new single actually kind of reminds me of The Stranglers. I meant to mention that earlier, thought I'd mention it now. AlexGreenBooks.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening with me and my literary career. My brand new book, The Adventure Teen All-Stars, is out now in paperback. Be a great beach read. You can finish it before the sun goes down. You can find out all about our radio station at bombshellradio.com. So many businessy things to go over, but there's more. Stereo Embers, the podcast, is available on all podcast platforms. Go to the one that you use, subscribe, rate, and review, and tell all your friends. You can find me on what's left of Twitter at Embers Editor or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or just email me, editor@stereoembersmagazine.com. Let's close the show with a longer listen to the song Hark by the Jack Rubies. This is the one, to me, that sounds like The Stranglers in all the best of ways. Enjoy it, and thank you as always for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.
Does anyone know the way?